Welcome to Season 15 of the Art of Teaching podcast. I'm Matthew Green, and I'm so grateful that you've joined me today. Before we get started with our discussion, I would like to acknowledge the Dharawal people, the traditional custodians of this land on which I'm recording, and pay respect to elders past, present, and emerging. I acknowledge the stories, traditions, and living cultures of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples on this land. Today I have the privilege of sharing a recent conversation that I had with the brilliant Lael Stone. Lael is an Australian speaker, educator and author, and is committed to supporting parents to understand their children, helping adults process their childhood trauma, and creating education systems that value emotional awareness. For Lael, everything is based on one fundamental principle, that of connection and compassion. The purpose of her work is to help all humans understand themselves better and be inspired to live the life they desire. I hope that you get as much out of this conversation as I did with the brilliant Lael Stone. Lael Stone, welcome to the podcast. Thanks so much for joining me. Where are you phoning in from?
Thanks for having me. I am down the surf coast in beautiful Victoria. It's a very sunny, gorgeous day today. It's, you know, I feel like autumn is in the air. Things are about to change, but I'm very blessed to live in a very beautiful part of the world.
Fantastic. And quite possibly the most important question for our conversation, what's your coffee order?
Oh, you're probably not going to like this. I actually don't drink coffee anymore. When I was a young mum, I did. But then I just found that it just made me too jittery, or if I didn't have it, I'd get a headache. And I was like, this isn't great. So I kind of weaned off to decaf, and now I'll drink tea. I love tea, but I absolutely love the smell of coffee. And my husband is like a coffee connoisseur. So, yeah. You know, he can tell you what a good coffee is, but unfortunately no longer. It doesn't serve me.
That's completely fine. My wife just made that switch as well. I think she's crazy, but she does seem to be enjoying her life more. So I think there's something in that about living a caffeine-free life.
Yeah. Look, I there's plenty of times where I'm like, wow, I'd like that. I mean, I actually don't drink alcohol either. Yeah. And there's sometimes where I'm like, God, I'd love that at the end of the day, but I just can't seem to make sense of it in my body these days. So I'm just like, we'll go without.
Nice. Is there a book that you've read recently that has caused you to reconsider a few things in your life?
Oh, that's a very good question. Probably at the moment I've been just reading trashy novels because it's my way of trying to switch off. I have a lot of information that I often take in, a lot of stuff I'm listening to. So at the moment I've actually put down reading anything that's remotely growth learning because I'm kind of like, I think my brain needs a break. So I don't know if there's any wisdom that I can, impart
trashy novels
I've been reading, but okay. I mean, I do love reading, but I think nothing comes to mind in the moment.
Yeah. Are you an avid podcaster or audiobook listener?
I do love podcasts. Yes. So I will often walk on the beach and listen to podcasts. So I do love learning and listening. But actually, I think, again, I lead a really busy life these days that if I have the opportunity for quiet, I'll actually take it. So sometimes I'm in the car and just being really still and quiet because I feel that there's a lot of noise around at the moment. So if I can take opportunities for quiet, I usually will.
Fantastic. And a final getting to know you question, what's something that you've recently changed your mind about?
Oh, these are good questions.
They make you think.
They do.
We can come back to that one, or if you think of something throughout the interview, we can.
You might have to come back to me on that.
No problem.
I'm stumped on that one.
I'm sure something will pop up in our discussion. Yeah. I just want to read a quote that you said, and sorry, it's always a bit awkward quoting to someone who said the quote, but bear with me. It said, ever since I could remember, I've always loved hearing people's stories. Humans fascinate me, and even as a little child, I wanted to know why people behaved the way that they do. Why is that something which has defined your work?
Yeah, that's thanks for sharing that. I think it's just, you know, we're all such beautiful different personalities. For me, understanding humans has always been really important. And I think actually as a child, I really developed that skill because I was really, really shy. So as a child, I was very slow to warm. I often felt really unsure. I didn't know really how to talk in groups of people. And I think one of the ways that I began to feel better about myself is by watching people and watching how they would behave. So I even remember as a 5 or 6 year old watching adults going, oh, they do that because they try to get people to laugh at them so they feel better. And this person does it like this. And so from a really young age, I was always really fascinated with why we do what we do, how do we feel a sense of belonging, like, and why, and really about behavior. And I do think as I reflect back that it was very much a self-protective mechanism just to help understand people better and to really help myself go, hey, we're all different and it's okay. And, you know, you don't have to be certain something to belong or to fit in. So, and I think as a young child, even as a teenager, you know, I would want to have these deep and meaningful conversations with my friends about, and I would say things like, what do you see that I need to work on in my personality? Wow. And like, what do you see where my hangups are? And my friends would just look at me blankly like, what on earth are you talking about? But I had a deep level of inquiry even as a teen. And I was very blessed that I actually had a mother who was a therapist and had spent a lot of her time traveling all over the world learning about metaphysics and spirituality and all sorts of stuff. So we would have some beautiful conversations and she really was a really beautiful guide and teacher for me. Wow. Around helping to understand who we are as humans and how we interact with each other.
I love that. And it doesn't seem like, I don't think there'd be too many teenagers that would be asking their friends about how they came across and they're sort of reflecting on their own behavior, which does seem quite unusual. Do you think that's, respectfully, do you think that is a little bit odd or do you think we should do that?
I'm sure it probably was. It's a bit odd.
I mean, odd is not bad.
But fascinatingly, actually, my three children are really similar because I think I do kind of believe this. I think when we're raised in environments where we have a deep level of connection and when we are allowed to express how we feel, when we feel really seen, we are going to often search for those kind of relationships, particularly in those teenage years and then in early adolescence. We're going to look for relationships that feel familiar to us around what it is to be seen and to be heard. So as much as it was probably strange, I look back now and think my family that I grew up in was probably one of the safest families amongst all my friends. So my parents were very open, they were very loving, they were very caring, incredibly supportive. And I look back now and realize, you know, it was the product of a safe environment, learning environment, and compared to what my other friends were kind of navigating. And I also think too, you know, I've watched this with my own children. I think when they've, you know, all felt and that experience of being seen or feeling connected to, they've also searched for similar stuff. So, I mean, this also shapes a lot of my work. You know, I really do believe when we can teach our children about emotional awareness and we can help them with emotional literacy, they are going to have these conversations more freely. So it won't be seen as strange that they actually will grow up with a deeper, beautiful understanding about who they are and why they do what they do.
I love that. And Lael, there's so much in that. I mean, there's almost a podcast episode in itself in the points that you raised there. But I just wanted to ask, what were some of the things that your parents did specifically to make or to build that safe home and make you feel seen? Did you have regular family dinners? Did you? Yeah. What were some of the things that you remember from your childhood that contributed to that?
I think that there was a very unconscious, deep acceptance of you can be whoever you want to be in the world. So there was never any pressure of you must get good grades, you must do this. There was like, and I remember my dad saying, I don't care what you do in the world, just find something that you love. Like you can always make money doing something that you love. And so he was always like, what do you love doing? Follow that. So we were really encouraged to follow our passions and what felt good for us, as crazy as it may seem. We would have weekly, what we would try and eat together as a family, but we would have a family meeting, which was called a What Pisses Us Off session. That's what the family meeting was. And we all had to go around the table and talk about what was annoying us or what was what we were frustrated with in the family. We all had to listen to each other. So that started from a really young age so that we could all talk about and share what was tricky in our families and where things felt. So I think that was really, you know, welcomed again, just that we had a voice, you know, even as a six-year-old, we were like, what are you finding frustrating? You know, and that was very, very important. Yeah. And I look, you know, and I really stand by this too. You know, my mother, without doubt, has always been a person that has a deep knowing or has a deep quest to know herself and to do what I call do the work. So understand who she is, do her healing work, not project that onto others. And that was modeled to me really, really strongly. Like, so even as a young kid, you know, when something would happen with a friend or something, you know, I'd sit down and chat to my mum, and my mum would be like, well, what are you making this mean here? And what is this about for you? And would help me understand humans better, you know, really understanding that concept of, when somebody's hurting, they often will hurt others, you know, hurt people. So, you know, there's those kind of things that that I think had an impact as well in helping me feel, you know, that it was, you know, it was really important to lean into where our stories are and what was going on.
Yeah, that's so important. And one of the things that we do as a family, we don't have a TV in our house. Our kids still watch movies. We project a movie onto the wall. My daughter's watching a movie now, but we don't have a TV. So, that's been really transformative. And for us, it's been like that for the last almost 20 years now. And so we'll sit around, we've got a huge dining room table. It's really big compared to the size of our house, kind of awkwardly large. And we'll sit around and we'll have these long dinners and these long conversations. And one of the things that my four-year-old loves doing is asking us what our favorite thing was from the day.
Yes.
And it's always with a four-year-old, it's always having dinner with my family, or it's building Lego or something. And one of the things I think my wife does really well is she always reminds me that these little conversations are actually really big conversations for little kids, and to sit around and to look people in the eye. Obviously our phones are away, and just have those conversations has been lovely. And what I'm starting to notice now with my six-year-old is that has really compounded. And so she'll be really willing to share some of those things that are happening at school, or some of those niggles. And I'm really grateful for those sort of habits that we get to build in families. And it's lovely to hear some of the things that you're really grateful for from your parents. And it seems like you had a really wonderful upbringing, which I think is really kind.
Yeah, I have spent the best part of 20 years listening to people's stories. And so, you know, I have heard a lot of pain, and there is a lot of pain out there. Yeah. And by all accounts, you know, I had a very safe, loved upbringing. And I also still had
challenges as well.
Yeah, of course, because I think we all do. You know, there is no utopian. We get it perfect. We're human, and we're going to have the human experience. So, you know, there is always still elements that we carry as children and what we make things mean within that. And so, but by most of this, you know, by really looking back at most of my childhood, I think I was very, very lucky to have a very stable, safe upbringing.
Yeah.
And with a parent who was really willing to look at their own story and model that.
And Layla, it would be amiss of me to ask you some parenting advice for when my kids become teenagers or adults in their early 20s. Mm-hmm. What are some of the things that you think parents need to do to help and support their kids as they move into those kind of teenage years? Because I'm slightly terrified, to be honest. but do you have any advice or any thoughts about how to navigate that season?
Look, I think, you know, the teenagers we want to raise starts when our kids are little, and it is those beautiful processes that you're probably doing now, which is the art of communicating well. It is listening. I mean, really, when parents say to me, what's your number one parenting tip? It is to listen. To listen without judgment, to listen without fixing, which is such a huge one, and to listen without kind of bringing our own drama and our own kind of freak out, you know, to whatever they're sharing with us.
Yeah.
And I really learned this. Like, I spent nearly 5 years working with teenagers in schools, teaching sex ed, and we would talk about well-being and sex education, relationships and all that kind of stuff. And every teenager I'd work with, I would ask them that same question, you know, if there was one thing you wish your parents would know, or there's one thing that you wish looked different, what would it be? And I think 85% of them would say, I just wish they would listen. Oh. And, you know, that really to me makes a lot of sense to a lot of the wounds that I work with adults mm-hmm. these days is really around the fact of not feeling like they were seen or they were heard or they were enough. And so when we're looking at how do we change that story for our own children is it's getting really good at nodding and saying yeah. things like, yeah, that sounds hard.
Yeah.
Tell me more. And not jumping into fix, not jumping into control what's going on, but being able to hold a really safe space for our children okay. to come to us and say, this isn't fair. I didn't get picked in the basketball team. And you know, such and such did, and that's not okay. And our reaction to be, gosh, that sounds big, my love. Like, tell me more.
Yeah.
And to be able to sit with them in the uncomfortableness. Now, particularly in those teenage years, as our beautiful teens have to figure out who they are outside of us. You know, they do this beautiful individuation process where they're separating from us, which can feel pretty scary as a parent. We're like, no, yeah. come back. Yeah. You know, they have to separate to figure out who they are outside of this family unit. And our job in those moments as those teenagers blossom is to hold the point of connection, even if it looks like they don't want to. And so that is constantly, you know, saying, hey, you want to hang out together? Do you want to do this? It's finding those moments of micro moments of connection, but it's also setting up that foundation of listening so right. that when the stuff is hard and when it's big, they know that you are the safest place to come. And so I think we are doing all of this work. You're doing this beautiful work now when, you know, when your girls are little, you're doing all that beautiful listening and play and connection, because that really does set up a beautiful foundation for our teenagers.
I was at the park this morning with my little one, and there's no judgment in this because I have done this as well, and I'm trying to get better at this. But I looked around and every single parent at the park was looking at their phone. Mm-hmm. And it really broke my heart, not only because I have been that parent, but also I thought about all of these sort of missed opportunities for connection. And I don't know if you can or have any thoughts on that, about the sort of the prevalence of technology and how distracting it can be. But I'm really starting to see, a lot of those sort of missed opportunities. But what are your thoughts on that? Because it's really difficult, isn't it, to be present?
Very difficult. You know, I think we are parenting in one of the trickiest times ever.
Yeah.
And, you know, not only do we have this pressure of, what a successful family, a successful parent yeah. looks like, you know, so we're trying to keep up with what all that looks like. We're also have a high level of stress, you know, with financial stresses and, you know, so we've got all those balls in the air. And then yeah. we have this massive influence of social media that mm-hmm. we often then compare ourselves to. So, you know, once upon a time, we would just compare ourselves to, you know, the other parents at school or, you know, the people in the shopping center, but now we're comparing ourselves to the world. So that's a huge extra pressure. And also, I think technology has become one of the biggest repression mechanisms that exist, which means right. that when we don't want to deal with stuff or when we don't want to feel, we can pick up our phones and we can just numb out by scrolling on Instagram for an hour yeah. or two. Now, we are all guilty of doing totally. This because it's, you know, again, there's times where we're like, I need to check out a bit and, you know, it's an easy way to do it. And maybe the equivalent to our parents was many, many years ago, it was reading a book, or maybe it was just watching television or something like that.
Yeah.
I think as humans, we all have the tendency to just need to numb at certain points because life is stressful. But when we are numbing more than we are feeling, that's when it becomes an issue.
Wow.
And I think again, too, we are living these very, very stressed environments that we're trying to cope, and the way that we cope is by numbing instead of actually tuning into ourselves, slowing down a bit and feeling. And so that impact then flows onto our children, whereas we can shove an iPad in front of them and go, oh, they'll be quiet for an hour. Good, now I can make dinner and I can return all the emails and do all those things. Now, we all do that at some point because we are juggling, right? We're not meant to be raising kids on our own in our own little houses. We're meant to be part of the village and we're not. So, you know, there is sometimes that's a beautiful thing, right? Because we're like, hey, I've got to get this stuff done. But I think it's becoming very easy to default to that all the time. And, you know, we know that technology and the internet and screens can actually bring some incredible stuff. You know, we are able to connect with each other in ways that we weren't before. We have access to more information, which can be extraordinary. There's a lot of amazing things. And then there's a lot of stuff that we know is quite damaging for children, for their brains, that can be very, very addictive. And, you know, I just say one of the biggest issues that I often see, particularly in the parenting space, is we're really quick to blame technology, phones, the internet, gaming, all that kind of stuff, because it's addictive and my child acts like this. But we have to be willing to be the antidote to that repression, which is connection. So if we are turning the screen off and we're taking the phone away, we need to then be present enough to connect with our kids, because otherwise a whole lot of their feelings are going to come up and then they're going to project that. And so it's a delicate dance in the world that we live in at the moment. And there is no doubt that our kids are watching us constantly. So if we are spending most of our time checking out, our kids are going, oh, that's what you do. You check out as well. Yeah. And it's hard not to, you know, I so get this. It's really tricky to put that down and to, you know, especially when we're tired, to connect, it can feel really hard. But my work has really been around, it's not so much about 3 hours of playing with your child. It is 20 minutes of 100%. Present playing, of being really present, not making a cup of tea, not picking up your phone, just being present with your child, delighting in them, playing what they want to play. That can often be enough to meet their needs of that beautiful connection. And then we can, you know, move on to do what we want to do.
I love that. And you have been a regular guest on one of my absolute favorite podcasts, which is the Imperfects podcast. And I remember hearing you talk about that. And it was like it was just this weight that I felt lifted, because I was trying to spend, I was focusing on quantity of time with my girls. And it was really difficult. I mean, you come home, especially in my role, if you've had kids shouting at you all day and people wanting stuff from you, to actually just be present for a couple of hours is really hard. And then when I heard you say that about, it's actually not about the quantity, it's about the quality. It was really transformative, because it sort of took the pressure off. And so what I try to do is just be 100% engaged in whatever my kids need. And I might get home at 6 and they're in bed by 7.
Yeah.
If I can be engaged for 1 hour, that just changes our family dynamic. And I'm not sure if you're familiar with the work by the amazing Dr. Adam Fraser. He talks about the third space, basically transitional spaces between home and school. And I've had the privilege of speaking to him a number of times on the podcast, but he talks about taking a moment and just asking yourself, how do I want to show up now? How do I want to show up for this interview? How do I want to show up with my kids? And even just taking 30 seconds to think about that. So sometimes I'll stand out the front door and go, I've had a day, but right now it's time to be a dad, or time to be a husband. And my kids freak out, because I always go straight to my wife and give her a kiss. And like, yeah, do you have to do that? And I'm like, yeah, I do. And you should see that. I know it's going to be gross. I know, but you need to see that.
That's good modeling, though. You know, I think, again, our kids are constantly watching, and come home and honor your partner and greet love them in that way is a beautiful thing. You know, they'll grow up going, that's what we should expect. You know, even if they're like, gross, you know, that's like, it's a good thing.
Yeah.
I used to joke with that with my, you know, my husband and I will often dance in the kitchen together or be really affectionate, and the kids are like, oh, and I'm like, no, this is setting down good pathways in your brain of what healthy relationships look like. And it's true. You know, they go, I'm not going to settle for anything less now. And I'm like, good for you. It's important.
I think one of the other sort of major things I've gotten from your work as well, and one of the things that we do in our family, is just say sorry quickly and say, you know what, I shouldn't have reacted like that, or I've had a bad day, or I just want to apologize. And embarrassingly, my 4-year-old and 6-year-old are much better at it than I am. They'll come up to me and say, daddy, do you need to make it right? And I'm like, I do need to make it right. And I think that's going back to that notion of self-awareness and actually going, okay, what's it like at the moment to be on the other side of me? And being able to admit, I think, when we make mistakes, and to show our kids that it's okay to have a day and then fix it. So there's so much in your work, Lael, that I think has had such an impact on us as a family. So thank you for that. I was just wondering, you've worked a lot with Woodland Primary School, and I just wanted to ask, as we kind of shift our focus towards education systems and developing compassionate and self-reflective children, what has some of your work been with Woodland Primary, and what are you most proud of with that project?
With Woodline. Yeah, so Woodline was never anything that I set out to create. So, I mean, I I mean, I kind of laugh sometimes that I created a school because I just go,
so cool.
It was never something on my radar. I didn't even like education. Like I didn't love being in secondary school and all right. That's good for. So it was never, and I'm not a trained teacher, even though I've worked with children and adults for a long time. But it really came about because one of my clients, Mel, was been working with me for a few years, and one of her kids was starting primary school, and she, you know, came for a session one day and she's just like, he hates it. You know, his name keeps being put on the board because he keeps moving, and he can't move his body when he wants to, he can't eat when he wants to. And, you know, she's from the USA and she's just like, is this what school is? And I'm like, yeah, pretty much. Yeah. And she just said to me, what if we built a school based on all the things you taught me? And, you know, I kind of laughed at first because I thought, don't be ridiculous. I don't know how to build a school. But she was really serious and she was like, no, Lael, like a lot of what you've taught me about connection and about listening to kids' feelings and about choice and autonomy, like what if that was part of what our school was? So, you know, she was really insistent. She had this beautiful like nudge and she was like, come on, let's do it. And, you know, I resisted for a while and then I thought, well, who am I not to do it? It just takes one person with a bit of vision and some courage to create something new. So yeah. I was like, okay, if we're going to do it, you know, then I really was like, I need the right people around me. So Mel, you know, she had the funds to do it. So she was like, I'll hold the infrastructure. You just build the school that you think.
Wow. What an opportunity.
It's huge. It's massive. Like I say that to teachers and their eyes go, my God, I would love that. But what was very interesting and what I've learned over these years, you know, we're in our fourth year now of our school, is I feel like being able to create what we did really came about because actually I wasn't an educator. I was coming from the place of a therapist. I was coming from the place of understanding trauma. A lot of my work is around trauma, of listening to thousands of adults talk about what happened when they were children. It was also coming from a place of watching my own three children struggle in the mainstream system. Mm-hmm. You know, one's an athlete, one's a creative, and one's what I call a disruptor. So she's basically like, why?
Yeah.
This makes no sense, right?
Yeah, I've got one of them.
Yeah, yep. All yeah. three of my kids were really struggled in the system and I didn't like it either. And really it allowed me to kind of look at what could we build where we know we have to tick the boxes. You know, we use the Australian curriculum, we are a registered school, so we have to do all the things that everything else, every other school does. But how can we use this curriculum in a creative way? How can we get as much choice and autonomy in here for the kids? How do we teach our children about emotional awareness, emotional intelligence? How can we make this a non-punitive school, which means we don't use any punishments and rewards? We are always looking behind the behavior of when kids are having a hard time. We want it to feel as relaxed as what it could feel like at home, you know, so kids can wear shoes or not shoes. They can sit on the couch. They can sit on the rug on the floor. They can learn in different ways that they learn. We're a play-based learning school, so we really value the power of play. You know, we follow a strong Reggio Emilia theme throughout our schooling. You know, we're on a beautiful 20-acre property, so we have animals and there is lots of land and trees to climb, and we do a lot of our learning outside. And so I think the initial vision that Mel and I had to bring it to life, it took 3 years. It's very hard to build a school. Like, there's a reason why not a lot of them pop up, because it's very difficult, costs a lot of money, there's a lot of red tape. It's a tricky thing to bring to life. And you know, the day we opened, I mean, I just cried the whole day because I couldn't believe that we'd done it. But I also was like, gosh, I hope this works, because, you know,
now all these
beautiful families had come along. And it's extraordinary now, 4 years in. I mean, gosh, we've learned so much. It's been huge, like huge. You have to do so much unlearning and lots of ideas that I thought I had that would work that didn't. And look, really 100%, it's our principal and the executive team and the incredible guides that we have. We call them guides at our school, not teachers, that have taken this concept and the possibility of something different. And they've really molded it into what it is. Like I just look at them and I often say that to our beautiful principal. I'm like, I set up the possibility and then you guys went, here we go. And it's extraordinary. Like I look at whenever I go back to the school, I just think this is far better than what I ever dreamed it up to be. You know, I used to, when I was building the school, I'd sit there and I'd dream up, what do I want the parents to feel like? What do I want the kids to feel like? What do I want the team to feel like? What do, you know, I really was visionary around what do I want this to look and feel like and how could we do it different? And so often my principal and I would be like, all right, what's not working? That's the contrast. What could we do? What is possible here. We were so about turning it on its head and everything was a learning opportunity instead of the kind of structured, but this is how it's done. And I'm like, but what about this way? And she'd be like, yeah, nah, that we can't do that. And then other times she'd be like, yeah, that's possible. So it's been this beautiful, glorious experiment. It's not really an experiment. I mean, we're doing beautifully now. You know, we have a massive wait list. It's pretty impossible to get into the school. And now actually help other people build schools. So I'm working with a beautiful woman in Queensland, in Currumbin, who's building a very similar school to what we're building. Because we see the impact of what we've got here. Our main focus is on developing the whole child, which is really around that emotional awareness. And not only have we seen extraordinary growth academically, because, you know, it's a bit easier to measure, but the emotional awareness, emotional intelligence element has been extraordinary in what we've witnessed with the children, what the parents reflect to us, you know, what the team sees. So it's been an extraordinary journey. I feel so proud of what we've created. You know, I still kind of pinch myself and go, I can't believe I created a school. It's so random. It's so weird. But I feel like it's just been one of those incredibly meant to be opportunities that I really do hope is a example of what is possible in what education could be.
I have so many questions. There's so many. I have so many things I want to know, but I think I've just got a couple of follow-up questions. You mentioned that there's no punishments and no rewards. I understand why there would be no punishments in a school, but why did you decide not to to remove rewards as well? What was your thinking behind that?
Well, the whole thing with punishments and rewards is I think they're the kind of same, you know, they're actually the same thing on some level, even though we kind of go, no, we've got to praise this and praise that. Yeah. You know, when we are praising one child for doing something, well, there's a few things that set up with that. And if anyone knows the work of Alfie Cohen, you know, he has a lot to say about this. So his book, Punished by Rewards, is a great book to lean into. Because really, I think what we see the impact of rewards is often it creates this extrinsic motivation of, well, what am I going to get if I do this? I think it also can kind of really, you know, we reward one child for doing something and the other child sitting there going, oh, well, am I not good enough? Because, you know, I haven't got that. We want to encourage growth. We want to encourage taking a risk. We want to encourage everybody's own unique development, not you are the best at this, right? We are all about encouraging the child no matter where they're at in their journey. So we don't do kind of, you know, we don't do rewards for kindness or rewards at assemblies for things like that. We don't even have assemblies. You know, we don't do those kind of things because we really wanted to take away this whole idea of you are good or you are bad, because really we don't, you know, we're not just prescribing to that you know, behaviorism paradigm. If we reward you when you're good and we take something away from you when you're bad, because there is so much evidence there of what that actually sets up for children.
Yeah.
You know, our philosophy, particularly around behavior, because it's one of the biggest questions we get asked, is, well, how do you navigate behavior? And so what we do as a whole school is, when a child is acting out, our job is really to look behind the behavior and ask the question, why? What's going on for that child? Do they need to eat? Do they need to move their body? Do they need some more information around what's actually going on? Have they had a really bad morning because there's a new baby in their family and, you know, they don't have any presence with mum or dad and it feels really intense, and actually what they need is some connection and some play, or they need someone to hold a safe space for them to have a cry and let out their feelings. You know, we're always looking deeper than what we're seeing on the surface, because, you know, my philosophy and my work is so much around there is always a reason for the behavior. So when kids are acting out, and this also ties into trauma, we know the impact of trauma, what are we seeing and what is happening here? And how do we support this child to come back into balance?
Yeah.
And my big vision around this was so much about, we want to keep talking about this. We want to have the language around it so that the children are able to identify, I feel out of balance, I need to do this. You know, it's a child's like, I can't sit still, I need to move my body. And we're like, great, do you want to jump on the trampoline? Do you want to have a swing? Do you want to go for a run? Like, what do you need to do? Some kids will come to us and go, I'm so angry. And we're like, awesome, how do we move this anger in a healthy way? Do we need to snap some sticks? Do we need to go outside and yell at the cows? Cows don't mind. Like, what do we need to do, you know, to move this in a healthy way? So we are we are developing this language around feelings and emotions to say feelings are not wrong, right? They're just there to help us express them in healthy ways. So as we model that as a team, as we support the children to feel in whatever way they need to, we then, you know, find that our kids are able to be able to find their way back into that balance, to be able to regulate themselves when they need to learn. And, you know, it takes time. It's taken time for the kids to learn that language and to be able to identify it. But my vision and goal is by the time they finish with us at Woodlawn and leave in grade six, they know how they learn best. They can identify when something's going on within them. They can ask for support if they need to. They have healthy ways of expressing those feelings. And they have a deep curiosity and love for learning. Like, that was my mission by the time they finish the school, that's who they know, that who they are.
And how, like, our teachers love measuring things. We love data, we love analyses and all that kind of stuff. It's very easy to measure academic outcomes, but how have you measured the well-being outcomes that this school builds into our students? And I guess a broader question is, should we be measuring well-being? Do you have any thoughts on that?
It's a really hard thing to measure. And, you know, we've had some conversations with some universities about doing some studies on our school, which I'm really all for, because I think there's this whole thing of we know what we're doing works and we see it. But I think for the rest of the world to catch up, you know, data speaks, right? They're like, oh, look, you know, what we see is this. So how do we measure it? We do a lot of, you know, every day at our guides, we only have 16 kids in a class, 16, 17 kids in a class. And we also have an assistant guide who's there to really emotionally hold space for the kids. So we have small class numbers, which means that our guides can really get to know these children and connect with them in big ways. So they're always tracking and watching what is happening. So there is that connection, which is very, very important in helping children to feel safe. So we've got that as a solid grounding to watch what we're seeing in development. We often send out surveys to the parents for them to reflect about what they're seeing. We get the kids to do their own surveys around how they feel and what we're seeing. So, you know, we're kind of bringing it all together on a few different levels to see what we are noticing within the children. And again, we are still a really young school. You know, we're in our fourth year now. We're still learning. We are still seeing what is possible within these spaces. You know, for me, one of my biggest things is, you know, I know that many schools are like, oh, we do well-being on Wednesday at 1 o'clock, and I'm like, well-being should not be just a 1 hour session a week. Well-being is through everything that we do. And so it is right from the beginning, how we connect with the students, with the children in the morning, how we greet them, how we, you know, give them the opportunity to move their bodies, to speak about how they're feeling, to, you know, just to be all about the connective relationships that we have. We're seeing it through everything. And so it's not necessarily a class that we're teaching. It is through what we model to the children, you know, the values that we bring to the school. It's through everything that we do. And really part of the vision of building this school is I was like, this cannot be just a token we do this. And part of that is our team, the people, the teachers who work at our school, they have to do their own work. You know, my job at the school these days is just to support our principal and executive team. So I get to go and just listen to their feelings. How are they, you know, what's going on? I welcome all their anger and frustrations and vulnerability. So they get a safe place. They have a safe place to let it out. And then they can hold space for the rest of the team. So the team, when they're feeling challenged by a child or when they've got their own stuff going on, again, there is safe spaces to be vulnerable and to let out their feelings. Because I'm like, we cannot do this for the children unless the adults are being held in that way as well. Yeah. So it has to be a whole big picture, right? It can't just be we say we do this, but then we punish kids. It doesn't work. We're giving completely mixed messages there. And I think that's one of my big things too. We want to teach children about resilience. Well, if we want to teach kids about resilience, we've got to make it safe enough for them to make a lot of mistakes, and we have to take punitive measures off the table.
I would love to come down and visit the school there. It just sounds like a really incredible place. And the more principals and school leaders that I speak to through this podcast, the more I realize that there's such a need for alternative models of education. And I was speaking to an incredible principal called Jackie Vaughan, who runs a school, who is similarly to you, has literally built a school from the ground up. And some of the questions that she asks are around the wellbeing space, like how do we make sure that when students leave this school that they are active, engaged, self-reflective contributors to society? And it's really lovely. I mean, what a privilege to get to ask these questions and to build a school. I couldn't imagine how complicated that is. But it was
very stressful.
Yeah, it sounds like a truly wonderful place. And Layo, you've talked, you've kind of mentioned a number of times the impact of trauma on young people. And I know that is where a lot of your professional expertise has been in. But would you mind maybe unpacking what trauma is, and also how it impacts young people?
Well, I think, you know, I know it sounds a strange thing to say, but I'm quite excited about the information we have about trauma these days, because I think even 10 years ago, if we mentioned the word trauma, we would think, oh, that's for people that have been through war or, you know, been in a really horrific accident. Whereas we actually all have trauma, you know, and there's a few different degrees of trauma. You know, we have something called complex trauma, which sounds like probably some of the beautiful kiddos that you work with at your school, where they are children that grow up in environments that are often high risk. So they don't know when their next meal is coming from. Perhaps there's addiction, maybe there's violence, there's abuse. There is a general sense of unsafety, you know, about them actually getting those basic needs met. And children with complex trauma, you know, are often, their nervous system is usually on very, very high alert. And they're often coming from a very, very highly protective state, which means, you know, any sense of threat, any time they feel unsure about something, any time they're feeling challenged, then their whole nervous system goes, this is not okay. And then they throw chairs or they get angry, they get aggressive. You know, I absolutely just stand by the fact that there is no such thing as a bad child. There are just kids that have got a lot of hurt and pain going on. So we see complex trauma children in often in low socioeconomic environments. You know, they're those beautiful kiddos that just need a lot of safety and connection even before they can start learning. And, you know, those are the children that we often, that society can criticize for them not learning, whereas, you know, their brains are constantly on high alert looking for safety.
Yeah.
And that's very hard to learn when we're in that state, you know. And for children like that, I think we need such a beautiful holding approach where there is a lot of safe adults around them to say, hey, we've got you here, and we are going to create some safety for you, for your nervous system to be able to navigate what's going on in your world. So I think, you know, we see complex trauma in that way. We then have things, something called acute trauma, which is usually when it's an incident or an event that happens. It might be in a car accident, might be a little kid gets bitten by a dog when they're little, might be that they have to go into hospital and have an operation. It's usually a one-off event where we have a shock in our body, in our system. And what our bodies do is our bodies go into that fight or flight response to try and protect ourselves. They might go into that freeze or fawn response where we try and, again, stay safe. And sometimes what happens with acute trauma is we have that huge fright, but we don't give our bodies the opportunity to process what's happened. And therefore we stay again in a bit of that fight or flight state. So whenever we are in a situation that has a similar kind of threat, the body goes into alarm again to go, something's wrong, you know. And so again, we can see that with some children, you know, that acute trauma, and it might be they are frightened of a dog. And then, you know, when something like a bee or a fly comes near them, they freak out because there's a similar kind of feeling of there's danger here, even though it's not something that's really scary. So, you know, we can have acute trauma. A lot of adults have got acute trauma from stuff that's happened a long, long time ago. And then there's something that I talk a lot about, which is what I call connection trauma, which is really around in our family units where we don't necessarily get our needs met.
Yeah,
and that can be around where it's not safe to cry as a child, or perhaps if we get angry, we're shut down and we're sent to our room. Maybe we got smacked and said, you know, I'll give you something to cry about. It's the times where we feel maybe really scared about something, and perhaps we got laughed at instead of we got attuned to and said, hey, I can see something's going on for you. So all of us as adults, we will have connection trauma because, you know, there's no perfect. And I think our parents from our generation were doing the best they could, as we always are.
Totally.
And I think these days we are learning a lot more about connection and attunement, that we are minimizing that a lot so that we're able to then help children process whatever feelings come up for them in a health safety way. So connection trauma is really about where we don't feel that we are deeply seen or it's safe to be who we need to be. And that's where attachment and separation can turn up a lot as well in that kind of connection trauma space. So we've got that that can turn up. And then we have something that is, again, getting a little bit more information around, which is great, is intergenerational trauma, or it's really about that traumas that have happened in our families of origin, perhaps our parents, our grandparents. And we see the ripple effects of that being passed down through epigenetics, which is really about through our genes of the trauma that's carried. And there's some really profound, incredible research around that these days, where we can see the effects of what's happened in the grandparents, in the grandchildren, which is wild, right? It's absolutely wild. But we are able to work with it. Here's the thing with trauma is that, I have seen the most extraordinary things over many years, even my own trauma journey of healing my own PTSD, of how we can work with trauma and heal it so it doesn't actually have to run us. Now, one of the questions I often ask educators when I go and speak at schools and we talk about children being in their bodies and connected to their body, so they're present to learn. And I say to staff often, what percentage of children do you think are actually in their bodies, and are present and connected in their bodies? And across the board, with all sorts of school I've spoken about, the general consensus is about 10 to 15% of kids, which means we have got a massive chunk of kids who are either in that whole fight or flight state, or they're totally disassociated and checked out. And then we throw in neurodiversity on top of that as well. You know, this is why I have the biggest dose of compassion and just amazing empathy towards any educator. I think you guys are absolutely extraordinary humans, because you are now teaching in a paradigm that is so, so challenging. And then we cop all this pressure from parents a lot of the time. So I just take my hat off to educators who are teaching often in a system that is not supportive of what is needed. There's a lot of pressure. And we're also now teaching a lot of children who are actually just, again, their nervous system is completely offline. And that's got a lot to sometimes do with what happens at home. It's to do with their own history. It's a mess. I'm not sounding very positive. It's a bit of a mess. It is. And this is why we see a lot of teachers burn out or leave the profession. And I think what we tried to do at Woodline is we look through this trauma-informed lens. So we are looking through that lens constantly of what's here for the child and what do they need. And sometimes that is, they just need a lot of play and connection before we do any learning, right? They need the evidence of safety for their nervous system that might be up here to actually really start to kind of regulate and find a place of calm. Then that can be their baseline, and then they work from, learn from there.
It seems like the role of loving parents and a connected home is really does form the foundation for our young people. And I think being a parent is, not everybody has the privilege of being a parent, but being an adult and being connected to the young people in your household it's an incredible privilege. And one of sort of my big fears, if I can get personal for the moment with my kids, is I just don't want to stuff it up. Like, I just don't want to, I mean, I look at my parents and there's so many things I look back in my childhood and think, that was crazy. Like, oh my goodness. And I'm sure there will be things that my kids go, oh my gosh, I can't believe we used to do that. But
yeah.
I just don't want to. I don't want to stuff it up. It's such a privilege.
I love that you say that because, it shows how much you care and you love your kids. And the reality is you're going to stuff it up at some point, right? We all are, because there's no perfect. Yeah. But here's the thing. You make it safe enough for them to come to you and say, Dad, I don't like how you spoke to me, or Dad, I don't like how you did that. Then you are going to be fine, because you have created enough safety for them to find their own voice to say, hey, this is what I feel. I mean, one of the big things I say to parents all the time is our job is not to raise good boys and good girls. It's not, right? We are not meant to be raising compliant children. We are wanting to raise kids who feel safe enough in their bodies, who are attuned to who they are, who know it's safe to use their voice to say, no, I don't like that. Or, this is what feels best for me. That is what we need to do. We need to raise kids that are connected enough to themselves, because when we're connected to ourselves, we connect to others, we connect to the earth, we take care of this planet, right? Definitely. That's what we're wanting to do in raising children. And I love that you're going, I just don't want to mess this up. Absolutely. Look, I mean, I laugh and
I will. There'll be something
I go, totally. I mean, I look at myself and go, I've done all the play and all the attachment and all the listening to feelings. And I remember when my daughter, you know, hit like 15 or 16 or something happened and she's like, I feel so anxious. And I'm like, no, you're not allowed to feel anxious. I've done everything right. Like this is, you know, this is, and I'm looking at her going, actually, no, you're a human. And yes, this is a normal part of being a human. And I realized that, you know, there is no perfect in parenting. And, but what we can do right as much as possible is make it safe enough for them to tell us how they feel around some of the stuff. And if we do that, then we're doing an incredible job.
I remember a couple of weeks ago, my daughter just wasn't picking up her stuff. And I just said, look, it was just frustrating me. And we'd been home all day. It was raining. I was cranky. And I said, if you do that again, I'm going to throw it over the balcony. Mm-hmm. And then I did. And then my four-year-old just came up to me and she held my hand and she goes, Daddy, you better go get that. I was like, okay, I'll go get that. And it's true. And I went to her and said, look, I'm really sorry. And we had a hug and we had a laugh about it. And I think it's okay, I think, to make mistakes. Okay. What was I thinking, throwing a toy off a bug?
Yeah, but you know, here's the beautiful thing around that is that you and your humanness were like, it's been a massive day, right? Like we've been inside, it's raining. You're allowed to feel like that. I mean, in an ideal world, we catch ourselves and go, yeah, probably not the right thing, but we are all going to mess up. Like, mate, the things I've done as a parent, I'm like, oof, that was not my finest moment. Yeah. But the important part is then you repair. And the important part, as you mentioned, this is to say, hey, that's on me. And that was nothing to do with you. That was my feelings, my frustrations. Yeah. I'm sorry. What do we need to do to repair here that feels good for you? Yeah. I mean, there is so much gold in that because you are modeling to your beautiful girls how to repair. You know, they are learning how to do that from an authentic place. That is a really beautiful thing. So, you know, there is no perfect. We are going to stuff it up. And I think it's really important what we do when we do mess up is in what we do after. That's the important piece.
Yeah. Layla, I feel like this has been a counselling session. This is great. I'm sure I will listen to this multiple times. I do want to be respectful of your time, so I just have a couple more questions. And one of them is, how do we look after ourselves? Because I know that when I've had a bit of a cranky day or when I'm flustered, things tend to come out that I regret. So what do we need to do practically as educators, as people that are involved in working with young children, to make sure that we are the best people that we can be? Do you have any practices that you do or any advice on that?
Well, I mean, the first thing is we want to bring enough mindfulness to catch where we're at, to be able to go, I don't have much left in the tank, or this is where I am. Like the first thing is being able to be aware enough of ourselves to go, yep, that's where I am, sitting on this scale of 1 to 10. And, you know, 10 is I'm about to lose it. I'm sitting at an 8. Okay, let's just catch that. I'm aware that I'm already like this. So I think the key thing for anybody is to find what works for them. From some of the things that I say to our guides or I do myself is we have to, when we're feeling stressed, we have to, on one level, our brain likes to understand why, but our body also needs a opportunity to move it. So I'm a big fan of just shaking, like just standing there and shaking my body, right? Shaking my body, like, getting it out, like just something to say to my body, you're carrying tension. How do we get this out? So we can shake, we can throw things, we can snap things, we can do something to move.
Shout at cows, maybe. If you
yes,
need
we can do that. I mean, yeah. This is the thing about anger, and it can be a low-level anger. Anger needs movement, right? We often just say, just breathe, but actually anger needs some movement, and then we can breathe after that. So that's why shaking can be good, pushing up against something, you know, throwing something safe, like those kind of things can feel good just to move it through the body. Breath can be amazing to bring yourself back to your center. Speaking, like having, you know, one of the things I'm really huge advocate for is what we call a listening partner, which is someone you can just voice note and go, God, today was really, really massive. Here's all the blah, 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 blah. And you just let it out. And the idea of a listening partner is not to fix you. It's not to offer suggestions. It's just to send you a message back and say, I got you. I hear you. It was a big day. You're doing a great job. And then you are also that listening partner for them. Now, the beautiful thing about when we speak our frustrations, it dissipates the charge of it, right? When we feel heard, particularly, not when we're being fixed, but when we feel heard, it gives us, again, more spaciousness to then hear others. So I think it works on a few different levels. We have to tune into what does the body need. For some people, that'll be going for a run. For some people, it'll be doing yoga. For some people, it'll be like having a shower. For some, it'll be shaking. Some will be putting on music and having a dance. It might be that. And then we also need to go, how do I meet the emotional needs? Now, that could be journaling. It could just be voice noting. It could be calling a friend. It could be something that is actually taking the frustration and all the stuff out to be able to let it go. I mean, one of the things that I love, my youngest works at our school and she works as an assistant guide. And so she basically holds space for kids' feelings all day. And she works with the little preppies, right? So she's with all the 5-year-olds. So she has got a monster job, right? And often when I pick her up, when she comes home, she walks in, she goes, right, I need to do the debrief. I'm like, go. And for 10, 15 minutes, she talks about all the things that have happened in a day, what she did, what she found frustrating. She's got to get it out so she can then let it go. And I'm like, brilliant. And then often she'll get it out and then she'll go, Mom, have you got any other tips? What should I do around that? Or is there a better game I could play with that? I mean, I love that she's so open to learning. But one of the most important things I say to her is, you have to shake off what is there so you are more spacious when you come back the next day to be present for kids. Now, that's equally hard if you are an educator at school and then you're coming home to be a parent. Like, you know, my daughter gets to come home and just go chill out and do whatever she wants. But when you are now coming on to put your parent hat on, that's really huge. So it's even more important that we have that self-care or whatever it is that we can do to bring ourselves back into our center. Yeah.
I think that's why I am very grateful for my commute to work.
Yes.
Is I have 40 minutes in the car on my own to listen to the Imperfects or Hamish and Andy podcasts and just laugh or call a friend. I think that's really important. And once again, I think that goes back to the work by Dr. Adam Fraser about having that transitional space between two things. And I felt that when I worked close to home and didn't have a commute, I felt that it quite often spilt out into my family. Yeah. And so I think that's so important to find what works for you and kind of embrace that. And that's really lovely. Lael, I was just wondering, I am going to come back to that question, that first question about what you've changed your mind about, but I'll give you a little bit of chance to think about that. We may edit it out if you decide there's nothing that you've changed your mind out about. But I just wanted to ask you a little bit. Your focus now is around, sorry, I'll rephrase that. I'll edit that bit out. I know that part of your work is focused on authentic leadership. Can you tell me a little bit about your work in that space and what you hope to kind of achieve in that space?
Well, the authentic leadership piece I think is really important because, and this is, I mean, I've learned so much from this, from our incredible, working with the incredible principal at our school, but also, you know, being able to guide many others who sit in those positions is really around how do we be the most authentic version of ourselves so we give our team permission to do that. And for me, authentic leadership, you know, comes down to a few different elements of how do we deal with connection. So what can connection look like? How do we meet people where they're at? How do we communicate, which is really actually about listening? Like, how can we deeply listen to what's going on for our team when we are leading in some way? How do we deal with what we call the contrast? So when things don't go well, right, how do we look at it? One of the things you know, I talk to our principal Claire about all the time is when something doesn't go wrong, you know, something doesn't go right, I'm always like, okay, there's the contrast of what we don't want. What do we do want? You know, what do we want this to look like? What is possible here? What a gift that we've been shown. What doesn't work? You know, whether that's with a team member that didn't work out or a family doesn't feel good or something we've tried, how beautiful. We've just got so much evidence that that doesn't feel good. Let's look at it this way, as opposed to, God, we've done it wrong and it's not all right. You know, I'm like, look at contrast instead of that we've messed up and we're getting it wrong. You know, contrast is a beautiful thing. You know, and really, I guess the whole thing around us as leaders is what do we need to own within ourselves? Because I really don't believe that you can you can ask your team to do stuff if you're not willing to do it yourself. And one of the biggest things we do at Woodline all the time is we really are inviting our team to be vulnerable, which means everybody's got to be vulnerable, right? We have to be vulnerable enough to own the stories that come up for us, what we make things mean, where we're at, doing our own work so that it is safe enough for the whole team. And I see that a lot in corporate organizations and in anything where there's leadership. You know, we can't just stand at the top if we are not willing to connect, if we're not willing to meet people where they're at, if we're not willing to own our own stuff and do the work. You know, we're not then going to be leading from that place of authenticity. And I think that's really important because at the end of the day, actually, as humans, we are always scanning, engaging someone's energy of are they authentic and are they real? It's what we do. We don't even realize we do it. We walk into a room, we meet someone, and instantly we're kind of reading their body language. We're scanning, do you feel like a safe person for me? Now, because that's our protective mechanism as humans, when we are working with someone or when we are in a leadership position, we want a person to be able to go, yeah, you feel like a safe person for me. I can come to you with my concerns, with my worries, with my ideas. I know I'm not going to be laughed at. I'm not going to be shot down. I'm not going to be mocked. I'm going to have someone say, thank you for bringing that to me. Hey, how could we all get our needs met here? What can we do to work with this? To me, that is really beautiful, authentic leadership of modeling and living. You know, what we want for our team is that we have to live it ourselves.
Love that. And something that you've changed your mind about?
Oh gosh, this is so good. I keep thinking about, is there some food that I like now?
Or something which maybe your understanding of has
developed
and shifted.
This is such a good, I'm never usually stumped for an answer, but this is a very good question. Okay. Oh, yeah, I have something.
Okay, great.
It's probably not that exciting, but it's something that I've really begun to appreciate and see. So my beautiful 24-year-old son is a climber, a rock climber, and he does bouldering. Wow. And I've always been like, oh, yeah, whatever. And then last year we all took a family trip to New Zealand, and, you know, he was just like, my God, this is like the mecca of climbing, right? Yeah. And one day we kind of went for this little hike and we really watched him climb. Like we sat there and, you know, he was bouldering, he was showing us. And I could not believe the skill, the strength, the intensity it took just to do these four moves to get up this, like he was literally hanging upside down. And I sat there in complete awe going, this is extreme. Like this is incredible skill and strength that I'd never appreciated. And so as I sat there and watched him work really hard, I was really in awe and I was like, this is an amazing thing. You know, I'd never really got it because I hadn't really been exposed to it. So
that is a great answer. Lael, final question. I'm so grateful that you would spend the time talking with me today. I remember emailing you and then getting a response and go, oh my gosh, this is happening. She's actually going to speak to me. Final question. If I was a teacher sitting down with you, drinking a coffee, you having some other beverage, what advice would you give me as I begin to enter the profession?
Yeah, I would say the most important piece of your job is connection.
Love that.
Is being able to look in a child's eyes and truly see them, even those kiddos that are the most challenging, but to get down on their level and see that behind the behavior and behind whoever's in front of you is a child that just deeply wants to be seen and to be acknowledged and to be loved. And fantastic. You are in the most incredibly powerful position where you have the opportunity to boost this child up to their greatness or to tear them down. So be mindful of your words. Like each day, get down on their level, look at them in their beautiful little eyes and really see who they are. And whatever it takes to try and find a way to connect with them, do that. Because that is where you will have the greatest impact on their lives. You know, we're all going to teach our kids to read and write, or we all hope they will at some point. But being that influence of beautiful, heartfelt connection, you do not underestimate how powerful that is and how far that will go in a child's life.
Amazing. Lael, it has been a huge privilege to get to connect with you today and to get to hear your story. And I'll make sure that I put links to everything that we've talked about in our show notes. But I can't thank you enough for taking the time to talk to me today. And I'm sure there will be teachers and educators all over the world that will get something truly meaningful from our discussion. So thank you so much.
Oh, thank you for having me. It's been a joy. And well done you. You've asked me questions that I have not been asked before. So
thank you so much for taking the time to listen to the podcast episode today. It's a privilege to get to share these conversations with you and continue to invest into our incredible profession. If you have a few moments, please do me a favor and leave a review on iTunes, Spotify, or through whichever platform you're listening today. If you wouldn't mind also hitting the subscribe button and sharing it with your networks, it would really help to get the word out to as many educators as possible. There are different ways to connect in the notes below, including links to the website, the Facebook group, Twitter, and Instagram. Thank you again for taking the time to listen. It means the world.